thank you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. I have a sense, I've been here because ISIS invited me to speak yesterday, so I've been here for a day and a half walking around, and I have to say it still does feel like the old, you know, funky, groovy place, and congratulations for that. I am very pleased and very impressed, especially as somebody who has been a professor at 3 American universities and 1 British university. As time goes on, one appreciates more and more Hampshire College and what is being done here. And one can't understand why the message doesn't get out faster and further that there is a better way to organize undergraduate education, at least for many students. What I'm going to do today, the topic, as he said, is a risk for me. And it's a new topic for me. It verges into both political theory, philosophy, and not only both those, and aesthetics a little bit. I'm not sure I certainly don't have the background academically or the credentials to be venturing where I'm venturing. But I'll give it a try, and I expect and I invite criticism and serious, strong, hard criticism. This is, if you like, part of a set of essays that I've been writing over the last couple of years directed to the various themes you'll see come out here. The only justification that I can give is the fact that, which I think is a fact, that certainly in the United States, less so in Europe, and I also am bringing to this the perspective of somebody who has worked in Europe for several years and now works in Canada. But even from that perspective, the notion of democracy is in crisis at the present time. And one is appalled, among the appalling things, of course, of the war that we just had, but by a number of events which seem to represent erosion of the notion of democracy or challenges to the notion of democracy without an adequate response, and trying to think about why there is not a really vigorous, adequate response led me to wonder whether the foundations intellectually, because for better or worse, I am a theorist, so my thoughts tend to theory, whether the sort of conceptual basis of our understanding of democracy, at least mine, because I started with my own thoughts, are in need of reinvigoration, challenges, criticism, and revival, and how to do that. Well, the main theme of what I'm going to say is that to think about really going back to the roots of the foundations of our ideas about a liberal democratic society, we have to go back historically to the philosophical ideas and the philosophical context within which, say, the notions of liberal democracy were born, the Enlightenment, John Locke, the French Revolution, and the American Revolution. And when you start to look at that, one is struck that there is an interplay between the ideas that were formulated then about society and ideas that were being formulated at the same time about space and time and motion. And that was the starting point that led me to ask if that's true, and I will argue in a very loose way into the talk that it might be true historically, might there be interesting resonances between questions that physicists and cosmologists are asking these days and questions that social theorists are asking these days? And certainly, and I will try very hard not to be naive and, you know, obviously stupid, and I'm not going to claim that there's some sort of deterministic link or sub-superstructure or something like that, but that there is, at any one time, a set of ideas and ways of thinking which are on the table for people to pick up and try to apply to their problems in their area, and that perhaps because of that, there one does see parallels between questions that people are asking in these different areas at different times, And I will present what I think is some evidence of such parallels at the present time. So that's the main theme. Here's sort of the outline, so people could have read it as they come in. There is also another reason for my interest in issues about governance, which is that 3 years ago, I was asked to be part of founding a research institute, an academic research institute, which is Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Canada. And that, after some discussion, was a tremendously exciting thing to imagine being part of. And indeed, after some discussion, I and two other people, Fotini Marcopulo and Rob Myers, agreed to be the core of the faculty or academic staff of this institute. And we arrived in September of 2001 in Waterloo and began to build a research institute. After a year and a half, this is the scientific staff of Perimeter Institute. And the adventure of growing this institute, and we have doubled, so we are now six staff, about 12 postdocs, four long-term visitors. We're going to about 50 to 60 people in all capacities over the next 6 to 8 years. So this is a very serious endeavor. And one of the ground rules we had from the people who founded and endowed the institute, the chief person, I should say, is Mike Lazaridis from Research in Motion, who contributed $100 million to the endowment. One of the few things that we got as ground rules from Mike is don't make this like a regular academic institution. Okay, make it democratic, genuinely democratic among the scientific staff, and genuinely without academic hierarchy, that in his view delayed and slows the progress of science, which is why he didn't give the money just to a university. So this has led us to talk a lot amongst ourselves as well as with others about issues about democratic governance amongst communities of scientists, and it's led us also to a lot of thought about what science is, how it works, and how do you make a community of scientists that can contribute in a sustained way, because anybody can have a good first few years, as I'm sure the people who've been here a long time appreciate. Let me segue. The beautiful thing about Hampshire was our experience being in the third class was fantastic. We got a great education. The wonderful thing is that now people are still getting great educations here, and the structure is more or less intact. That's the achievement. And our challenge is not can we have a good first 5 years when everybody is very excited, but 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now, will this institute be a place which is on the edge, leading the edge scientifically? So those are some of the issues. As you can see, we have a diverse staff. I'll come back at the end maybe to talk about who some of the people are. As you can see, we, like all people in physical scientists, science have an issue about there being not enough women and minorities in the field, which is something you can also come back to. Here are some of the questions that we ask ourselves, going in. Universities come from schools of theology, and that is historically, schools of theology were designed to perpetuate old established authoritative knowledge from generation to generation. Are those institutions the best way to incubate new knowledge and to organize communities of scientists whose mission is discovery of new knowledge? And in particular, do people take enough risk in academic science? Okay. And is the scientific community organized in such a way to really motivate and support scientists, and especially young scientists, to take the amount of risk that they really feel they want to take, or does it hold them back? There are also issues of hierarchy and power, and what Mike was doing when he said to us, don't be hierarchical, was responding to the paradox of the organization of science, especially in my field of theoretical physics, where predominantly important new ideas come from younger people or from older people who have recently switched fields and begun something afresh. Okay, but the power, and power is a big issue in the academic world, is held by older people. Does that slow the progress of science, and does that contradiction matter? So these were some of the issues. And finally, we wanted to have fun. There are great scientific institutes like that institute in Princeton where I spent some time, which have great reputations over years and they hire great people, but nobody enjoys being there. Can we have a place where people enjoy being, and is that was at least part of our conception of how to make a first rank scientific institute, as well as how are we going to attract people to this little peaceful social democracy that nobody's ever heard of? Okay. And again, part of the idea of this is a conscious of the founders is this is not to rearrange the positions of Canadian scientists. Of the people in that picture that I showed you, only three of them are Canadian by birth. Okay. Like many things that Canada is doing, the intention is to draw educated, talented people to their country. And I'm one of them, and I'll be talking about why in a minute. Okay. Well, so to start to get at some of these questions, you have to talk about really why does science work? And I'll start off by assuming that science does work. Okay, we can argue later if somebody wants to argue that the science doesn't work. I think the historical record is that it works tremendously. How? And when I was here, I took courses in philosophy in which people discussed the history of these ideas. Here's a one-slide version of the history of philosophy of science in the 20th century. And I was taught everything up to Feyerabend and here. In fact, Kuhn was assigned in more than half the classes I took. Kuhn's great book, which was supposed to explain everything about everything in those days. I don't know if it's read anymore. And basically, the conclusion of people propose various things, and they're all good advice at times. It's good to try to make theories that agree with experiment. It's good to try to make theories that are falsifiable. It's good to try to make scientific revolutions. But there's a difference between good advice and an explanation or an understanding of how science works. There's a difference between what's good advice for a working scientist that you can exploit and really an understanding of how it works. And none of these seems to work. And really, Feyerabend, who I read after I was here, I think he was a little bit too radical even for the philosophers who were here at that time, who argued that there simply is no scientific method. And he convincingly argued that there is no scientific method. So how does it work? And I don't know if some people teach here, but you know, if there is no set of no methodology that you can say you follow this methodology and you will find truth about whatever the subject is, how does it actually work? And in particular, how do we reason from shared data, from shared evidence, which is, however, always incomplete, to reasoned, rational conclusions? Because that's what scientists do. And how do they do that? And I want to argue that that's also what democratic societies have to do to progress and to work coherently, is to find ways to reason together from shared evidence to decisions and policies. Well, I have a try at a characterization. And if somebody wants to rip this apart, I would appreciate it. Okay, this is my attempt at answering the question, how does science work? And my proposal is that science works because historically, scientists are members of communities defined by certain ethical precepts. So I call them ethical communities. And the intention here, by the way, is very non-Platonic and very non-utopic. When I say that a community is defined by a set of ethical precepts, I don't believe and don't require that everybody in the community follows those ethical precepts all the time, or even that any person follows them all the time in their whole career. But there still is a set of principles that everybody, if asked, would agree to, that I would claim define a community. So here are some of the things that all scientists would agree at least we should do. And I would argue enough of us follow these precepts enough of the time that we do reach truth about nature. So first, we agree that we argue in good faith from shared evidence to reasoned conclusions. We agree that we honestly report the effect, the results of our investigations, whether they agree with our initial assumptions or not. Now, can anybody be a member of this community? Say we're talking, and I'm talking about science as a set of communities, theoretical physicists, topologists, algebraic geometers, etc. I'm talking about communities at that scale of really what the subject. Can anybody be a member? No. Anybody can't be a member. Anybody can propose to be a member, but to become a member, you have to be trained in a craft. And why is that? The reason is that one of the historical bases for science and for the scientific endeavor is the recognition that we human beings, as smart as we are, like compared to, you know, dogs and cats and stuff, are really prone to error and really easily fool ourselves and confuse ourselves. It's really easy for an individual human being or a community of human beings to convince themselves of something which actually later turns out to be something they have no evidence for. It's not true. And to counter that tendency, the communities of scientists and the traditions behind those communities historically have developed craft of how to do calculations, how to do proofs, how to do experiments, such that the results are reliable and repeatable. And it's mastery of those crafts that defines, it's mastery of those crafts together with agreement to the basic ethical principles that I think defines membership in these communities. And so you have to agree to learn a craft which has been evolved to detect and root out error. Okay. And then be eligible for membership. Okay. Now then there's an interesting tension in the scientific community, in a healthy scientific community, between a rebellious aspect and a respectful aspect. Okay. Scientists have to come in with a rebellious attitude. You have to come in with an attitude that you can do better than your teachers, or you're not going to do anything. You might as well not waste your time and do something else. You have to really believe that everything before you is inferior and you can do better. You have to be a rebel to be a good scientist. And you have to believe, okay, in your own conclusions and your own hunches and your own guesses. Okay. And I think the ethics of science enforce that by actually requiring you to argue honestly as hard as you can and advocate as hard as you can what you believe. If you don't, if you begin to advocate what older, powerful people believe and not what you believe, that scientific community withers and dies because it loses this rebellious aspect. At the same time, there is a respectful aspect, which is that you respect the fact that you're in a community which has a long tradition that goes back generations, and that as hard as you have to fight for what you believe, the ultimate judge is the community and not yourself. The ultimate judge of the worth of your, in your life of effort is not yourself, but the community. In fact, the real ultimate judge are the members of your community 50 years from now, after your career is over, and somebody that you had no chance to influence in any way personally writes the textbooks. And your career succeeded if something that you did is believed, becomes part of consensus 50 years afterwards. And so it's that tension between the respect and the rebellion that I think makes the theory, makes science work. Okay. So this characterization of science is part of why I think that science is deeply related to the notion of democracy, because the principles that I just expounded, in the same sense of imperfectly, not everybody follows them. If you ask what are the ethics required to be a citizen as part of a democracy, whether a democracy is a community or scholars, like Perimeter, or whether a community is Amherst or the United States or Toronto, okay, it requires adoption of ethical principles that put the judgment of the democratic process to make decisions over an individual, but also requires the individual to to fight in good faith as hard as they can for what they believe. So that's where I start. Now, there's another characteristic of scientific communities that are not always shared by political communities, which is the characteristic I call imaginative communities. And these are communities oriented towards the future. That is, a community is an imaginative community if the members of it understand and expect that the members of the community in the future will likely think that they were wrong about most things. An imaginative community is one that's set up to and expects to generate new knowledge, new ideas. And an imaginative community is one that's set up to evolve as new evidence, new data, new situations are encountered, and in particular, to evolve in some way which doesn't break the structure of the community. And I would argue that the, if you like, the in the 20th century, in a very oversimplified case, the legacy of my grandparents, who were Marxists, okay, was that to make a just society, you had to revolutionize the society. I think the 20th century experiment with that failed, and we're still really looking for a framework to understand how a democratic society can continually evolve and improve itself without having to suffer the fracture of violence coming from revolution, civil war, etc. I would say that the challenge is to figure out how to make democratic societies imaginative societies that have built in the expectation of evolution and change. Okay. And I would argue that in trying to think about how that can happen, we can use the scientific community as an example of a community that is both ethical and imaginative. Now, another issue that faces democracy now, that's a kind of issue or crisis for democracy, is pluralism. That is, in the old-fashioned, some people say, you know, liberal Enlightenment notion of democracy, of which there are many, many good and important things still true about, okay, the citizens of democracy were envisioned as being entirely identical. One had certain rights, one had certain responsibilities, there were certain roles, everybody lived in a society subject to law. But the theorizing, as far as I can tell, about liberal democratic society, it rests on the assumption that society is made out of individuals who are all identical in the same way, and I think this is not an accident, that matter is made out of atoms, which are believed to be all identical. Something that our North American societies, the United States, Canada even more, European societies less, but is coming fast, have to deal with is that that's not true. Our democratic societies are made of people with a whole wide variety of experiences, histories, backgrounds, philosophies, religions, etc. And this is the issue of pluralism. And there's an American academic response to pluralism, which I'm going to be criticizing in a little bit, the sort of postmodern response, basically to go from, if there's no right single point of view, then all points of view are equivalent. Okay. And therefore to go to a kind of relativism in which all different points of view, all different responses are equal and are equally valid, and there's no need to try to reach conclusions, shared conclusions, within the different elements of a pluralistic society. And there's a growing split in the academy between scientists and people from the humanities. And one of the sources of that, I think, is that the people in the humanities keep talking about pluralism and multiculturalism and diversity, and we in the scientific community have been living it, especially in the American scientific community, because the American strategy for dominating the world scientifically, rather than excellent secondary, elementary and secondary education, the American strategy is immigration of scientifically trained people and people trained in science and engineering. So the American scientific community, increasingly the world scientific community, is increasingly made up of people from all over the world. So we live with this issue. And I find language to discuss this, I find the language of Pico Iyer. People here know Pico. Pico Iyer is an essayist and a novelist. He has a book called Global Soul, in which he identifies a kind of person who he calls a global soul. And you're a global soul, and the issue here is migration, but not migration of uneducated people, refugees, etc. The issue here is migration of the most talented and best educated people on the planet. And what Pico Iyer has identified is a rapidly growing body of highly educated, highly influential people in the most influential professions who are mobile and live and work in different countries than their countries of origin. And he calls these people global souls. So you're a global soul if you're living, if you're working in a different country than you were born, or were educated in a different country than you were born, if you're married to or have a partner from a country, if your children have a different citizenship than you do, or as he put it, if you spend more time on airplanes and in airports than you do with your parents or your brothers and sisters, okay, then you're a global soul. And Pico argues, well, before I get to that, I will note that that's what we have at Perimeter. That's the list of countries that the people on the slide I told you come from. And this is typical of scientific academic community in North America, and increasingly typical in Europe and even Japan. Okay. Now, Pico argues, and here I'm really just mirroring him, but I think it's interesting and it fits in, you'll see that it fits into the argument I'm making in an interesting way, that as an increasingly number of people in the most influential professions, academics, science, art, also business management, entertainment, are in this category of people, so you have a situation where there's an increasing proportion of people in the most influential professions living. And you can see them in cities where they're clustered, like London, the American coastal cities, Toronto, even Tokyo, etc., living in kind of ghettos where they meet other people like themselves. And hardly anybody in these communities votes locally. What's happening politically as an increasing number of influential people are living in countries other than that where they have citizenship and would have the right to vote. Some of them can vote at home, some of them not. And the picture is there a framework, an intellectual framework, for how these people fit into the democratic process, which is necessarily global? Because such people, for such people, the old boys' network are irrelevant, all the sort of arrangements that arise in local communities are irrelevant. How do they fit into the politics of the places where they happen to live? Okay. And a key point, which one sees already discussed extensively in Europe and is a key idea in Canada, okay, is that the success of democratic societies will depend on their ability to lure such people and keep such people living there. And the small democratic countries, like, you know, Holland, Denmark, the other Scandinavian countries, but even Italy and Canada, know this and are thinking a lot about this question. And I think in the United States, we've already been doing it, so in a certain sense, we haven't been. So is there a model of democracy appropriate to a community, a pluralistic community? So all that I've really done here in the last few slides is raise the issue of pluralism and ask, is there a model for how to think about democracy appropriate to an increasingly pluralistic world? And might it be the scientific community, because we have a lot of experience within the scientific community, of how to reach consensus and decisions amongst people with a huge variety of different backgrounds, how to reason together in spite of going home to home where we speak different languages and have different religions and eat different foods and listen to different music. And can we imagine a democratic society, can we have a picture or a concept of a democratic society appropriate either at the level of a community of scientists, a university, a research institute, a city, or larger, appropriate to putting pluralism as a key problem? So to try to answer that question, I'm going to argue that maybe we should look at this possible analogy between ideas in science and ideas in social theory. Okay. And so far, I've just been giving you watered down Pico Iyer and other people. Okay. This is the point where I really take a leap and probably fall down. I probably have what's coming down from the north and have scientific arrogance syndrome. SARS. I will argue that our concepts of democratic society have evolved in stages with our ideas about space and time, and that if we accept that, we can then ask, is there something to learn about the future of democratic society from ideas that are being examined in science now? Okay. So I would argue that there are, and this again, if I gave you the 20th century philosophy of science in one slide, this is 1,000 or 2,000 years, it doesn't really matter which, of intellectual history in three slides. Okay, so you can really criticize me for being superficial, but I'm trying to find a basis to go forward. Okay, so first, scientific cosmology, formulated vaguely by Plato and Aristotle, and then a mathematically precise way by Ptolemy in the 3rd century AD in Alexandria, was as pictured here. The universe is hierarchical. God and the angels live outside in the higher sphere. The lowest in the center is the earth, where human beings live. Surrounding them is a set of concentric spheres on which are affixed the moon, the sun, the planets, and then finally the final sphere is the stars, and God and the angels live outside the final sphere. And God, the whole thing rotates by a set of interlocking gears that they all worked out in a lot of detail, and God keeps the whole thing going by rotating the outer sphere perpetually. And that was a mathematical model, and using a mathematical model, it's very important to teach this, you know, to not be disrespectful of it. Okay, the mathematical model that came from this worked till three decimal places to predict where the planets and the moon and the sun were in the sky. It worked until people had the accuracy of telescopic observations, a little bit less than that. It worked till Tycho Brahe in 1600 to his observations. Okay. And now you can make some statements about their version of the universe. All properties, like where something is, are defined with respect to the hierarchy. There's an observer who sees everything, who is God, who lives outside. Okay. And then you can look at that, stand back and look at that, and realize that in a certain cartoonish way, this is a picture also of medieval society, and also of the relationship between human beings and God, which was conceptually the basis of medieval society, was the same hierarchical picture. The same logic of ideas frames both their theological conceptions, their political conceptions, and their conceptions of space and time and the universe. And also, the whole thing is eternal and static. It's always been that way, and it always will be that way. So that's the first stage. Second stage was Newtonian physics, which was created by Newton in 1687 after a period of about 140 years of revolution, starting with Copernicus, who said that perhaps the sun was at the center of the universe and not the earth. Actually, if you look at it in detail, okay, actually all Copernicus said is the sun is near the center of the universe. The sun was not actually at the center of the Copernican universe when you looked in detail. But in any case, Newton, after a long period of revolution, replaced it with a picture in which there is no longer a hierarchy. Instead, space is completely homogeneous. It's the same everywhere. It's just through Euclidean space, like you learned about in ninth grade. No matter how far you go, space is always the same. Okay? And things that live in the space have properties which are defined with respect to space. So where something is, how fast it's moving, all the properties that physics described. And John Locke, the political philosopher, argued that all properties like colors, smells, etc., reduced to properties that could be defined with respect to space, roughly where something is and how it's moving, what shape is it. OK, Okay. These are all defined with respect to this background space. This background space is eternal. It's pre-existing. It's always been there and always will be there, but it's not hierarchical, and everything that exists has an equal relation to it. The properties of a particle are defined with respect to that. All atoms have the same properties. They're all equal. An atom, you can talk about where one atom is and how it's moving, whether it's the only atom in the universe, whether it exists in a universe with billions of atoms. The other atoms have no effect on the property of an individual atom. And God is still, in a sense, outside the universe, seeing everything, although Newton also sometimes said that and sometimes said that space is a sensorium of God and God pervades the whole universe. But the point again is that there is this entity, God, who is eternal, who is outside the scheme of things being described, who really gives everything and its properties. Now, one can argue that the same logic describes liberal social theory. There is a fixed and absolute definition of justice and rights, which liberal jurists would say it is the responsibility of judges to discover through their process of judging and for philosophers to discover. All individuals have the same rights. I have the same rights whether I live in a society with one person, five people, or 260 million people. The shape of the society, the history of the society, the existence of other people with other agendas doesn't affect my rights and my situation. So a citizen in a liberal democracy is in a sense analogous to an atom in a Newtonian space. And I hope if you can see the analogy, okay, I'm not the inventor of this idea, something that a lot of scholars have talked about. And it's interesting that this is not an accident, i.e. John Locke and Isaac Newton were friends. And they read each other's stuff as they were formulating each other's stuff. Okay. So that's how it was until the 20th century. Okay. Now, over the 20th century, on the science side, and now I'm just going to talk about the science side for a few minutes, that notion of space has been overthrown. So this is the third step. Okay. And this is really what general relativity, Einstein's theory of space and time is about. And to some extent, it's what quantum theory is about. And instead, the picture that we have is a picture of a relational, what I call a relational pluralistic universe, which is nothing but an ever-evolving network of relationships. There's nothing fixed. Things have definition, not with respect to some absolute fixed notion of space and time, but with respect to each other. All properties of things are about relationships between in this relational pluralistic world. And there is no longer a notion of how it looks from the outside. There's no longer an omniscient observer who knows where everything is and how everything is moving. All observers are part of and embedded in this network of relationships and have partial knowledge as a result of that. Okay. This is not just pictures. This is the way, really, in up till the minute theoretical physics, we talk about space and time. The most up-to-date stuff, which is the quantum theory of gravity, which is what my day job is when I'm not making a fool of myself like this, is to describe what the geometry of space and time is quantum mechanically. And the pictures that we draw are pictures like these. These are pictures for applications in a field called loop quantum gravity, which is a subfield of quantum gravity. And we describe the quantum geometry of space and time as networks of relationships, which are evolving. And we care a lot about issues like where is the observer in this network of relationships, and what to do about the fact that the observer only has partial information in the universe. These are things that we care about. In fact, we care about them so much that we've discovered that mathematicians care about them. And the transition to a relational pluralistic world is something which pervades even mathematics and even the foundations of mathematics. And I think there are a few mathematicians here. One way to talk about this is that there are some people who work on the issues of philosophical foundations of mathematics who are shifting to a view based on a notion called category. Okay. which is more relational. And in particular, what's important about this is that, as opposed to old ideas about mathematics, which are based on set theory, okay, this foundation of mathematics are based on different notions of logic. In the traditional Platonic logic, okay, or what's called technically Boolean logic, you have as an axiom A or not A. Okay. A proposition is either true or not true, and then you go there. Now, a logic based on A or not A assumes that there is an omniscient observer, that that whoever is doing the logic can actually establish whether any proposition is true or false at any time. So it implies a kind of Platonic eternal world. Okay. These newer kinds of logic, called intuitionistic logic, don't assume that. They allow for the possibility that the answer to a question, you know, is there a dog on the moon, is not yes or no, but we don't know yet. And so they're more complicated mathematically, and they have within them the idea of a situated observer, a situated thinker, doing the logic inside the system. And so I would argue this transition from an absolute framework of in which something's relation, absolute, unchanging absolute, defines what it is, to a relational pluralistic framework in which all judgments and all observers are situated, is happening even in pure mathematics and logic. And since there aren't really, and as well as physics, and I won't dwell on this because I don't want to keep you too long, okay? And there are some cool things I want to get to in a minute, but this transition is pervasive, I would argue, in science, in physical science. So if we have in physical science a transition from this absolute Newtonian framework to a relational pluralistic framework, what about social theory? Is social theory becoming relational or pluralistic? And I started, when I got to this point in my own thinking, I started asking people who knew something about social theory, and I got the response that yes, social theory is becoming more pluralistic in relation. I'll give you some quotes. This is a professor of law at Harvard, Roberto Unger, who, by the way, is a global soul, who was born in Brazil, is a professor at Harvard Law School, and spends a lot of time in Brazil as an advisor to politicians there. So he has this, both the practical and the academic. And he is interested in cosmology. This is from one of his works on social theory. And I won't read the whole thing, but he says, you can trace properties of the present universe back to properties it must have had at the beginning, but you cannot show that these are the only properties that the universe might have had. And I'll just skip to the bottom. If you want to read more, you can. Only a relative distinction exists between law-like explanation and a narration of a one-time historical sequence. This is somebody who is, when he says that, it means that the idea that there is absolute law, which is eternal and based on symbols, and then the application of that law and a clear division between the two is gone in his thinking about society. And he goes on, if you were asked what you mean by the necessity of the laws of nature, that is the necessity of the most essential things, the most essential relations, you can legitimately respond only by laying out the substance of your cosmological and other scientific ideas. That is, he's saying he can't do social theory without getting to the thought about science and cosmology. And he says, people who appeal to fixed conceptions of necessity, contingency, and possibility are simply confused. Okay? So Roberto is in our camp. Here is Drusilla Cornell, is a feminist scholar, a professor of law now at Rutgers. And she says, the central thesis of autopoiesis, and I don't really know what that is, but it's some notion of self-organization in law. It doesn't matter, you'll see it by context, is that legal propositions or norms must be understood within a self-generated system of communication with which both defines the relations with the outside environment and provides itself with its own mechanisms of justification. Again, a system of relations within which truth values or determines and judgments are made without reference to anything that is external. Okay? The distinction between a system and its environment means that there is an inevitable tension. What she's saying there is something that I understand from my own work, and it's hard to get, so you may not get it. but I put it there because it's something that I get from my own work, it's that the notion of time is deeply related to the attempt to make a distinction between a system and its environment, which is somehow something more permanent than that system. And I love, all these people told me I had to read Jacques Derrida, and I tried to read Jacques Derrida, I never understood anything he said, this one phrase. Okay. So I put it there, it is always an I who says we, which says again, okay, there's always, the social theorist is always situated within the society. Okay. And that's something, again, of relevance to us cosmologists. Okay. Now, postmodernism. I want to talk about a little bit about postmodernism. Because what I'm advocating here is a view I'll call relationalism, which is not the same thing as relativism. Relativism, a social theory or a philosophy, is relativist if it says that there is no absolute reference point. Okay? That since there's no absolute reference point, there's no eternal framework by which things are justified, then every act is equivalent. Every statement is equivalent morally and aesthetically. And truth and beauty become, quote, suspect categories. And you hear strange things like, there aren't really authors, there isn't really truth, there isn't really beauty, so forth. Okay. And a relativist, like certain communities of sociologists of science, who I think are relativists, would argue that there is no absolute rules for scientific method, and science is just sociology, and truth is just an illusion created by mechanisms of power, sociologically. Relationalism is different. All points of view and all experiences are not equally valid. And here I hearken back to my definition of science. To be taken seriously, you have to argue ethically. To be taken seriously within a community defined by a set of relationships between the people in the community, you have to argue ethically and you must practice your craft well. And there has to be a commitment that when there is shared evidence, we argue to, you come to consensus. And so what I'm arguing for is that whereas in a relativist, postmodern kind of framework, in the no truth, there's no beauty, here there is, okay, but without an absolute eternal judgment. Now, where did I learn this? Okay, I learned this. And I want to go just a few more minutes, so bear with me just a few more minutes. The rest will be fun. Okay. How did I learn to think about postmodernism? I learned about it from the artists. And here there's an issue in the academy that I want to stress. I mean, I'm a theorist, right? I'm a theorist. And when I started to hear about all this postmodern stuff, I went to people in the humanities who were doing it. And I said, can you explain to me what all this stuff is about? And we never could get it. We never could communicate. There was a blockage. And I tried, and people from the other side tried. And I was part of various study groups where we read Habermas or Derrida or people like that. And it just did not go across to us scientists. And I know a number of other scientists who had the same experience. Then I met some artists, visual artists, who I was easily able to communicate with. And I'm going to, the last part of the talk here will be what I learned from them, because really everything I've said, in a certain sense, I learned from my encounters with people who make visual art. And the reason, there are two reasons. One of them is that visual artists have had to deal with postmodern critics because their livelihood depends. Unlike academics, their sales depend on what critics say about them. And they can't make a living and support their families and feed their children and send them to college, okay, unless they can answer their critics. It's really true. And it's a group of intellectuals in an interesting situation that academics are not in. And what the conclusion that I've come to is actually that there's a lot of affinity between those of us in science and people in visual arts. And the reason is, and there's less affinity between either group and humanists. And the reason is that humanists work with texts, which is it's a good thing to do. It's a quite, you know, it's a good tradition, the tradition of working with texts and textual criticism. There's nothing wrong with it. I have nothing against it. Except when people who work with texts say that nature is a text or an artwork is a text, and they don't understand the difference between working with texts and working with your hands. And the difference between working with texts and working with your hands is that when you are a scientist or an artist, you work on the edge of failure all the time. you work in a situation in which you can always blow it, you can always make a misstep, and if you're not careful and if you're not well-trained, you're likely to. And even if you are careful and well-trained, you're likely to fall into irrelevance, okay, with what you do. Okay. So there is a notion of John Brockman, which I ascribe to, that the conflict between the two cultures, which C.P. Snow talked about, is resolved in a kind of third culture in which there are scientists, visual artists. He puts digerati. Digerati are the computer software people. Now, this doesn't mean that they're the same thing. And here's a quote from an artist that I've learned a great deal from, St. Clair Semen, who is another global soul, who has been educated in France, working in New York for many years. And St. Clair says that in both art and science, we strive for universal knowledge, but not of the same kind. In science, one works to extract universals from the particular. In art, we begin from the particular and we go to the even more particular. In this process, knowledge is extracted from a process, art, that is already pure knowledge to begin with. And what he means by that is that there's a craft of knowledge. When he comes to a material, he brings. And that's entirely what his work is. Now, it was St. Clair who told me what postmodernism was. Okay. And this is a quote from a phone call. He said, if the purpose of modernism in art was to burn the old classical house down, all that postmodernism has been doing is playing with the charred little pieces that are left, which is a pretty puerile thing to be doing considering that winter is coming. And I think about that a lot when I think about the situation of intellectuals in the United States and what we've been doing for my professional life and what we've been unable to do. Well, since he taught me a lot, here is one of his pieces, Homage to Darwin, Homage to Sartre. This is a more serious piece, At the Tribunal of One's Life. One in many, on that piece of paper reflected in the mirror, it says chair. You can't see it. First lesson, and then spring. And I showed that because one thing that he said to me once over dinner is that the hardest thing for an artist to imagine doing in the present environment, in the face of the postmodern critics, is to make a mother and child without irony, or quotation. This is Donna Moylan, another a painter, also in New York, also a global soul from Boston, but she lived for 20 years in Rome as part of the artistic community there and recently moved back to New York. And she has been influenced with category theorists in mathematics about notions of truth and time and how they interplay. This is just some. And then this is another global soul, Ray Smith, who's a Mexican, works in both Cuernavaca and New York. And the point is that what these say, you see, I couldn't come to you and do what I really want to be able to say, which is that in spite of relativism, in spite of realizing that there is no absolute framework behind everything, okay, in spite of there being no justification to refer to and fall back on, except our own communities, science proceeds and makes progress. And I can't prove that to you, but what I can show you is that in spite of all those things, artists still make beautiful things and still are working within our beauty. And that's really what I want to communicate. To conclude, and I'll now bring the different strands of what I'm saying together, and conclude, I think that the democratic process is in crisis, and it's in crisis externally for all the reasons that we hear about in the news, but I suspect it's also in crisis because the intellectual and philosophical framework which gave meaning to liberal democracy was closely related to our ideas about space and time. That is, the idea that it made sense to say that there's an absolute background, okay, with respect to which an individual gets rights, or with respect to which we can make a determination of justice, and what is justice and what is not justice, okay, that determination was rooted in an idea which had its roots in how people thought about space and time, that space and time were there, absolute and for all time, in the same way that notions of justice were there for all time, absolutely. Okay. And in the 20th century, both on the social side, on the scientific side, and also on the artistic side, although I just touched on that, the notion that things had ultimate value with respect to some external system was demolished from all sides. Okay. And intellectuals, especially in the United States, okay, have tended to respond to that by saying, okay, there's no absolute justification for things. Then we become postmodernists. That's what it means to become postmodernist, according to some people. And we just become relativist. There's no notion of truth which is absolute. Okay, then there's no notion of truth. There's no notion of beauty or justice. Okay, so justice are just social constructions. Okay. And what I'm arguing is that that's a mistake. That's a wrong turn. It's a wrong turn which has captured a lot of people, intellectuals, a lot of people in the academy, especially, again, in English-speaking countries, but not only. Okay? And that we are suffering from that wrong turn because we don't have a basis on why we can say when something is just or not, when something is true or not. Okay? And what I argued is that perhaps the rescue comes from where the notion of democracy got its original strength, which is how people, the most basic thing people think about the world they're in, even if they're not conscious of it, is how do they situate themselves with respect to space and time. And since ideas about how we situate ourselves with respect to space and time have changed and become relational and pluralistic, as I argued, that the way forward with notions of democracy and social theory is also to become relational and pluralistic, which is not the same as relativistic. And with it, with a notion like a notion of an ethical community and an imaginative community, you can have a network of relations in a community define what we mean by truth or progress or beauty or justice, okay, in a way that's for real and not just relative, okay, in a way that has teeth. Okay. And I have tried to argue, first by showing you some pictures, that some artists already have this message. And these are the post-postmodern artists. And they are going on, they're happy to talk about what's beautiful and not. And they're happy to talk about progress in art. Okay. And I tried to show you by making some quotations that at least some of the leading social theorists are also onto this, both the connection to science and notions of space and time, and the idea that the foundations of social thought might be in a relational pluralistic picture. Okay. So I've taken big risk here. I'm tempted to say in closing, I mean, I'm very, very happy to be here, to come back to Hampshire. I don't want to blame it on Herb and my other teachers here. David is up there. It's not your fault if everything I said was dumb. But I hope at least to have pointed to some directions and some questions. And if you go away with anything, okay, you may disagree with what I said, you may think it's silly. The idea that there are analogies between questions that we theoretical physicists and cosmologists are asking, and social theorists and artists, all of whom consider themselves on the cutting edge of what they're doing, and all of whom are consciously responding to the collapse of the 18th and 19th century paradigms, to show that I read Thomas Kuhn's book that you assigned me, and the failure so far in the 20th century to really respond to that collapse of 18th and 19th century ideas. And we really hope that, I mean, it took 150 years roughly to go from Copernicus to Newton and solidify that change and get rid of the Aristotelian world. So we still have some time to complete this transition, but I hope that perhaps some students from here will be able to participate in that and carry it through. So thank you.
Concepts of space and time are more than just relational. There's a lot of other tricks in the 20th century, in the 21st century bag of tricks about space and time. And as you're talking, I'm thinking about more exotic quantum mechanics, and is there a social side of entanglement or non-classical correlations and so on. The second thought that came to me, though, was that, unfortunately, most of those concepts are incomprehensible to almost everybody, despite your excellent efforts in some of your writing for popular writers. And so the pessimistic question is, what are your thoughts on the possibility of social theorists and the public at large sufficiently grokking 20th or modern concepts of space and time that we could actually allow them to influence our thinking about social systems?
Well, so that's, I'll be quick because there are other questions, because there was three different questions.
Okay.
One, okay, I do think that the transition from a framework where properties are defined with respect to a fixed, unchanging, eternal background to being defined in terms of an evolving network of relations, I do think that is the one sentence summary of the revolution in physics that started in the 20th century and we're hoping to complete very soon, we hope. And I think that all those other things are aspects of it, and the failure so far to comprehend quantum mechanics coherently, which I think is a failure and is part of why evolution isn't open, I don't think there's a coherent understanding of quantum mechanics. Because the way that I see it is that there's a kind of nostalgia for the absolute that different people, there's always something that people are unwilling to give up, rooted there. And in the stuff that I find most interesting in recent ideas about quantum mechanics, these ideas about category theory and partial knowledge play a key role in observers being embedded in the system. As far as the other, no. Okay, I am optimistic. In the same sense that, you know, you can read the postmodernists who tell you that you never can understand somebody from another culture or of another gender, you know, or another ethnic background, but then you go to Japan and you see their art, or you go to India and you listen to their music, and you understand it. I don't think we human beings have trouble understanding each other. And I think the people who have trouble understanding are the people who have to process through some methodology about text. I really do, okay? And I think that, he has no background, he doesn't know what he's talking about, but Roberto Unger has gotten the key point about 20th century cosmology. I have no idea how, because he doesn't even know calculus. I mean, I talked to him, okay? Drusilla Cornell was a math major, and that may have helped her. Her undergraduate major was in logic and foundations of mathematics, so she has a little bit of help into it, being a legal theorist, okay? But this stuff is not that hard, okay? And St. Clair Simin went to Belles Arts in Paris. He has no scientific education. Okay, Donna Moylan, I think, has no degrees at all. Okay, so I think that human beings are learn easily. Okay, and what human beings are really good at, you know, from the beginning, is learning from insufficient data. And I don't want to make an evolutionary thing. If I had another hour, I would make. Try to tie this all in some kind of evolutionary picture and really make a fool of myself. But I think that drawing deductions from incomplete information is why we're a successful species. Okay. And I think that we can have a lot of useful conversations across disciplinary boundaries without having to know each other's crafts. We have to be humble, we have to know the limitations, but I'm optimistic. So this guy here, then over there.
I liked a lot of your conclusions and ideas of space and time affecting ideas of democracy and stuff. I felt like a lot of the ways in which you went about them were a little questionable in terms of the fact that the progress people when we see that most of the intellectual trajectories that you were tracing are really coming out of Europe and out of a very small group of people if you're looking in terms of the world. And then many of the cultures that maybe don't exist anymore or were either exterminated or somehow influenced rather harshly by Western imperialist interests generally had similar, or maybe not similar, I'm not trying to romanticize, but just like they had different kinds of ways of relating to time and space, just saying, are now being developed within these small groups of scientists. And I think that those kind of cultures and ideas need to be brought into this kind of dialogue, and I think we need to like really be careful about the fact that we can't just assume that there's a progressive space-time kind of idea, which I think is kind of what we're looking at in your talk here. I think we need to kind of have more evidence for the fact that there is an idea of progress, because I don't really see that as what's actually happening.
Okay, I don't want to... We disagree very strongly. Okay, and when I was... Okay, so let me try to explain why I disagree. Okay, because in our ethics and what we're after, in our values, I think we agree. Okay, and I think we disagree because, first of all, I live in a scientific community which is international. Okay, for me, this is not an issue about whether Japanese people or Indian people or African people or people from Trinidad can be scientists or smart. Okay, because they are. Okay, and for us, it's no issue. It's really no. I mean, there are issues of there is discrimination practiced in various sectors of the academy because people are ignorant. Okay? Okay. Silicon Valley runs on the energies of people who come from non-Western cultures, who learn science and engineering really easily, first of all. Secondly, I will agree with you about imperialism, agree with you about dominance. I will agree with you on the political agenda. Okay, but I think the way in which it's turned, the way in which you've turned it, and many people turn it, okay, I think leads to a view which is wrong, which is deeply pessimistic, and which gives us in the West, okay, who are, if when I meet a Japanese philosopher, okay, or somebody from Africa, okay, or, you know, I'm invited to go out to an American Indian community near Seattle to talk about what I think about space time with it. Okay. If I'm to meet them as an equal, okay, I will no more be ashamed of. I mean, yes, my intellectual heritage is in Western society. My intellectual forebears are, you know, Newton, Leibniz, Galileo, Newton, Kepler, okay, etc. For sure, okay. And I don't think that's. Yes. There was imperialism, etc. Okay, but I think that doesn't mean that there is not a coherence and a centrality and an importance to the tradition that comes from them. Okay, now a couple of things. Okay, I did not say, okay, as somebody might say. Okay, I mean, I did not say, as Margaret Thatcher said, that you have to come from an English-speaking country to understand democracy. Okay, I'm not making that argument. Okay, I think that democracy is a universal human value. I think that the struggle for just governance, okay, is a universal human struggle that one sees in the history of all the different societies. I also believe that there's been much more interplay between the different old traditions than is usually taught. That is, Leibniz, who is, I didn't mention this, but Leibniz is really the intellectual founder for the Western tradition of this notion of pluralistic relational ways of thinking. Leibniz was, some people have called Leibniz the best mathematician who ever lived, whatever. He was an inventor of calculus. He was a contemporary of Newton. He was an opponent of Newton, who put forward the view that was instantiated in Einstein's theory as a counter to Newton when Newton was alive. Okay. Leibniz read translations, Indian and Buddhist philosophy from the Jesuits. Okay. And if somebody wanted to, you can make a case that the framework of ideas that I'm talking about came through the Jesuits from the Eastern traditions into the Western tradition because Leibniz and other people read them. Okay. I don't think that they're...
Why do you give them any credit if that's where it's coming from?
I'm giving... I agree with you. Yes, and there's also the big issue of how much of what's called Greek science, okay, was a very creative synthesis made by people in those Greek city-states of ideas coming from Near East Asia and Africa, you know, Egypt and so forth. And that, those are cases to be made by scholars. Okay, But I sit here, okay, and I interact with people from their tradition. So I want to say two things. One of them, I interact with people from other traditions, and we have no problem doing science together, whether they come from an Islamic country, a Far Eastern country, a South Asian country, you know, whatever. Okay, we have no problem doing science together, and I don't think it's because science is somehow a Western thing that they have gotten, you know, colonized and adopted. It's because there is a notion that anybody can adopt. Okay, and my parents practiced Buddhism. I mean, you know, these things are exchanged all over. What I would like to find is a foundation for a pluralistic world. Okay, but a pluralistic world shouldn't respect. What am I trying to say? Nothing should be respected just because it has a great tradition and there are pretty who follow this. Things should be respected because they're beautiful, they're meaningful, they appeal to people, they lead to truth, they cure diseases, okay? And when I, you know, I, anyway, and okay. There was somebody, this guy there was first. Now we're getting excited. Now that I'm really exposing what I'm going
to
do.
The question that it seemed to me that you were trying to pose for us and you didn't really quite put there in your talk is how can we redevelop an ethical community in contemporary democracies?
Yes.
And I say kind of redevelop since I agree with you completely that things are in a state of crisis. I think one of the reasons why you didn't really get too far in saying how we can do that is I think you got kind of hung up on a bogeyman, which you don't need, and it's really kind of false bogeyman, and that's the whole kind of discourse on postmodernism. First of all,
maybe it's over.
First of all, it's over. Yeah. Second of all, the equation of postmodernism with relativism is, I think, extremely simplistic and wrong-headed.
Okay.
And third of all, I don't think there's anyone who really espouses that kind of extreme relativism that all acts are equivalent, who would want to call themselves a postmodernist. But aside from all that, the question then is why is there a crisis in the ethical community now in democracy? And I say I think you have the wrong book, but I think one of the things that really needs to be explored, and this is what I was really interested about in the first half of your talk and the stuff about the scientific community, is I think there's a crisis in scientific communities as well. And I think that the one thing that you gave a really kind of inspiring and idealistic, somewhat abstract discussion of the scientific community, and the one thing that seemed to me was missing there was any talk at all of institutions, any actual institutions. And the ways in which, from my understanding, what happens in science, and one could make somewhat equivalent statements in terms of what happens in democracies, deviates from the wonderful picture of how a scientific community should operate, has so much to do with institutional forces and the way in which people operate within institutions, the way in which universities are very much kind of going off track due to so many things that have to do with the way in which one gets grants in science, the way in which the whole commercialization and, you know, money-making, profit-making. So much of it has to do with the way in which people are kind of situated in specific institutions with forces that affect greatly how people interact other than just in this kind of ideal sense of a kind of community of people who share ideas. And so I think what we need to really be kind of addressed rather than a kind of bogeyman of relativism is how our institutions are themselves in crisis and what we can do to make them more ethical in the ways that you're pushing for.
So all those questions are very fair, thank you. Very briefly, because there's a lot to say about those things. There are issues with institutions, there are issues with grants and so forth. And we are, you know, we're very aware at Perimeter of these kinds of issues. And we're trying to make a counterexample. We're trying to make an example. Okay? And for example, one of the issues of the many that you talked about is there's a basic structural instability in the organization of science. There are many good things about the organization of science, but there's a basic structural instability, which is that seniority brings power, and success brings power for a long time after the success. And the result is that a lot of what happens in the scientific community can be characterized by older people with agendas, scientific agendas and programs, which are decades old, being able to impose on young scientists to work on their programs and agendas by controlling funding, by controlling positions. Okay. And the result, I think, is that in the fields that I know about, it greatly slows the progress of science, because if an agenda is still there to be worked on after 30 years, it probably failed. And the fact that somebody can enforce its continuance for another scientific generation, if not beyond, slows down the progress of science and prevents young people, because young people do not feel free in the environment to pursue their own agendas. And that's a serious problem. And our solution for it at Perimeter, I mean, I am the oldest person at Perimeter, period. I mean, we have a visitor who's older, okay? I'm older than Mike Lazaridis, who donated the $100 million. I'm older than Howard Burton, who was the executive director who pulled the thing together, and I'm older than the other scientists. Okay, in the scientific decision making, I have one vote. Okay, and we're trying to build an environment in which not only can I be criticized when my science is out of date, but I can be fired when my science is out of date. Okay, and made to go be a professor in an ordinary university, which is, after all, not a terrible fate. And we're trying to see, can you have a scientific community with the views of the younger people, once they're in and accredited, really carry equal weight for real as the older people? And even for us, it's a challenge. And even for us, for example, you know, the board of directors, some of the people, they don't understand, they don't get it. You know, and we have to keep reminding them, not Mike Lazaridis, but some of the bankers, we have to keep reminding them that this is not really like banking. How to affect such change in the American academic community, you know, I have no idea. I gave up. That's why I took this job, because I could not see how, as a professor in a major research university, there is a choice. Pursue your agenda of research, enjoy teaching, mentoring students, try for an administrative position of power and try to institute the ideals you believe in. Okay. But it's war, okay, at least in the places I work. So, and I agree this, so my sense is, just like Hampshire is an example and a demonstration, and I think it's a demonstration which should be much more widely and strongly pushed now that it has a clear record of success. Our strategy is a demonstration. There were other hands. Go from the back. Yeah.
Let's say we grant the sort of historical story that you told about the connections between understanding the physical world and the moral world. Why take that as something we ought to admire or follow or take as indicative of anything important? My point is this: why is that what we take to be morally and politically salient features of the world and how to understand it ought to be importantly tied into the natural or the physical world? I mean, it might be that Aristotle had a big picture where it all fits together, but why is it that we ought to be sympathetic to that instead of saying, well, when you get really good at this stuff, you know, you're going to say the hell with trying to tie it to physics or, you know, bowing before the natural scientists, and maybe you'll come up with something that has very little to do with inquiry in the natural sciences.
The point is very well taken, and the only thing that I would say is that it's interesting that people trying to push their fields ahead can recognize the problems and the discussions in the other fields and find them, see similarities. Okay, there's no way in which a social theorist can convince his or her colleagues by making a move and saying this is justified in science or art or any of us. I mean, what we do has to stand up in our own communities. But I'm not making a should argument. I agree with you. There's so many hands. This guy here. By the way, somebody else wants to call on people, that's fine too. Yeah.
two questions.
Okay.
One was, you were talking about, or one of the questions was talking about problems in basic research and finding funding and bureaucratic issues. And I think another big issue is sort of industry and corporate funding, how most of research in America comes from industry, and whether corporate and economic agenda, whether that's having a negative impact on the direction of science. And my other question is, if you consider what's going on in contemporary science as a revolution, are you sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop in social science and in popular culture?
So the only answer to the first question is, you have to pick your battles. Well, each of us has battles, and fight what we can fight best. Okay, I'm a very anti-Platonic, anti-utopian person. I wouldn't advocate any global solution to any of us. As to the second, it's not a question of let me just say again what I said to him. I think it's interesting that, you know, that Roberta Unger finds it interesting to know what's happening in cosmology and sees analogies. And when I understand talking about, I can see analogies, which I can expand on. And the same thing with the artists, but they're only analogies. I don't know, it doesn't seem to me that problematic to explain why, at any one time, there's a small number of really original ideas on the table. Okay? Really, genuinely original ideas, genuinely powerful responses to a crisis are few and far between. Okay? It's not surprising that they filter, or that they arise, wherever they arise, they filter amongst thoughtful, inquisitive people across a range of disciplines. I don't think there's anything explanatory.
So you think it's just because they're unique and original that they appear in so many fields?
I think they're powerful ideas. They're powerful ideas, they have teeth, they get you somewhere, and I'm not a scholar, okay? I mean, this is a job for the people who do studies. I mean, there's, you know, to really find the roots of ideas and where they come from and how ideas lead to other ideas, that's difficult scholarly work, and I'm not trained for that, so I certainly don't know.
If I might, we've lost a number of people. I've noticed it's past 5:30 now, so maybe one more question and then we can move to the reception.
Why don't you choose? I'm happy to.
Isn't the life of the cosmos, as you've argued so eloquently yourself in your writings, and therefore, if we really sense that, isn't that really the big message of science today, all the branches of science coming together in this idea of universal evolution, that we are recycled stardust, that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, that there is always more, more, more? I mean, why do we have this crisis if we have this understanding truly behind democracy too, isn't it? I mean, you're the one that's been arguing about this, haven't you?
So a couple of things, okay. If I had more time, okay, and I mean it, okay, if I had more time, I would argue, as I did a little bit in that book, okay, that there is a deep logical relationship between the relational pluralistic picture and an evolutionary picture, that they're different sides of the same coin. Okay, and I didn't get that here, okay, but I do agree with that. Okay, however, okay, I mean, the time in which I wrote that book was a heady optimistic time, in which one could go hang out at the Santa Fe Institute and know that Al Gore and Paul Krugman were coming by, and that have this idea that the world was all going this way, and that, you know, there were, you know, a lot of progress was happening both technologically, scientifically, socially, politically, and everybody was getting this message, okay, it turns out that view was very superficial, okay, and I think that the present political crisis can be overstated. Okay, and the present international crisis definitely is okay. But just a sort of, well, it's all right because it's evolution, okay, wasn't good enough. And it wasn't good enough economically. That is, people who thought, you know, the fact that all the investment banks were full of young physicists and mathematicians who thought they knew how the economy worked because they could make models based on evolutionary biology, and therefore their banks could make 20% a year forever. Okay? I mean, they with actually people, you know, people who knew something about business, maybe. So there was a lot of sort of headiness that went into that book, which is wonderful, but I think that what's missing from the mood and what you characterized it, to me, was the ethical moral basis of it. That is, okay, it's no, it, for reasons that were already articulated, okay, in their questions, okay, you can't just say because it comes from science or because we evolved that therefore it's good and therefore it's going to turn out well. There has to be, ethics isn't like that and life isn't like that. It's based on difficult decisions, on, as I stressed, okay, somehow making decisions, whether they're policy decisions or political decisions or scientific decisions, always based on complete evidence and always within a pluralistic setting. Okay? And this is an ethical act. The good faith required to communicate and engage with people with a different viewpoint in the hope of reaching some agreement, of some even agreement to disagree, okay, is an ethical act. And I think that realization is something that I didn't have when I wrote that. And what I'm looking for is foundation. What I'm looking for is an understanding which has the notion of ethically chosen acts at the foundation of the whole thing, because somehow I sensed that was what was missing.
Thank you. I think... We'll continue our conversations in the lobby where we have a reception awaiting.
Okay.